Cassette 8, Side 2.
She was sweating inside her windsuit. She hustled down into the next canyon and ran it for a while, west, southwest. Then she saw an easy ramp and ran up to the next intercanyon strip, a kind of wide, high road between the shallow canyons on both sides. Looking back, she found herself staring at the polar bear. It stood on all fours, behind and two canyons over, looking like a very big dog, or a cross between a dog and a person, draped in straw-white fur. It amazed her to see such a creature out there. The food chain couldn't possibly support such a large predator. Could it? They must surely be feeding it at feed stations. Hopefully so, or else it would be very hungry. Now it dropped into the canyon, two over, out of sight, and Anne started to run down the strip toward her rover. Despite her running around and the tight, rugged horizon, she was confident of her sense of the car's location. She kept to a pace she thought she could sustain for the whole distance. It was hard not to let loose and sprint at full speed, but no, that would lead to a collapse eventually. Pace yourself, she thought, gasping in short pants. Get down off the high ground into a graben so you're out of sight. Keep oriented. Are you passing south of the rover? Back up to the higher ground for just a moment to look. There behind that low flat-topped hill, which was a small crater with a hump on the south end of the rim, she was certain, though the rover was still out of sight, and the jumbled land was easy to get confused in. A thousand times she had gotten briefly semi-lost, unsure of her exact location in relation to some fixed point, usually her parked rover. Not a big deal, usually, as her wrist's APS could always lead her back. As it could now, too. But she was sure it was over there behind that bump of a crater. The cold air burned in her lungs. She recalled the emergency face mask in her backpack and stopped and yanked off the backpack and dug, pulled off the CO2 mask and put on the air mask. It contained a short supply of compressed oxygen in its frame, and with it pulled over her mouth and nose and turned on, she was suddenly stronger, faster, could hold a better pace. She ran along a strip of high ground between canyons, hoping to get a sighting of the rover round the slope of the crater apron. Ah, there it was! Panting triumphantly, she sucked down the cool oxygen. It tasted lovely, but wasn't enough to stop her gasping. If she went down into the trough to her right, it looked like it would run straight to the rover. She glanced back and saw the polar bear running, too, legs now in a shambling kind of gallop, lumbering. But it ate up the ground with that run, and the shallow canyon wall seemed no impediment to it. It flowed over them like a white nightmare, a thing beautiful and terrifying, the liquid flow of its muscles loose under thick yellow-tipped white fur. All this she saw in a single moment of the utmost clarity, everything in her field of vision distinct and acute and luminous, as if lit from within. Even running as hard as she could, focusing on the ground to make sure she didn't trip over anything, she still saw the bear flowing over the red slope like an afterimage. Pounding, running hard, boulder ballet, the bear was fast and the terrain nothing to it, but she too was an animal. She too had spent years in the backcountry of Mars, many more years in fact than this young bear, and she could run like an ibex over the terrain, from bedrock to boulder to sand to rubble, pushing hard, but perfectly balanced, in control of the dash and running for her life. And besides, the rover was near. Just up one last canyon side and the slope of the apron, and there it was. She almost ran into it, stopped, reared up, and pounded the curved metal side with a hard, triumphant wham, as if it were the bear's snout. And then, with a second, more controlled punch to the locked door console, she was inside. Inside, and the outer locked door closed behind her. She hurried upstairs to the driver's area to look back. Through the glass, she saw the polar bear below, inspecting her vehicle from a respectful distance. Out of dart gun range, sniffing thoughtfully. Anne was sweating hard, still gasping hard for air, in and out, in and out. What violent paroxysms the ribcage could go through. And there she was, sitting safe in the driver's seat. She only had to close her eyes, and she saw again that heraldic image of the bear flowing over the rock. But open them, and there the dashboard gleamed, bright and artificial and familiar. Ah, so strange. She was still in a kind of shock a couple of days later, able to see the polar bear if she closed her eyes and thought about it, distracted. By night the ice in the bay boomed and groaned, sometimes cracked explosively, so that she dreamed of the assault on Sheffield, groaning herself. By day she drove so carelessly that she had to put the rover on automatic pilot, instructing it to make its way along the shore of the crater bay. While it rolled, she wandered around the driver's compartment, her mind racing, out of control. Nothing to be done but laugh and endure it. Strike the walls, stare out the windows. The bear was gone, but it wasn't. She looked it up. Ursus maritimus, ocean bear. The Inuit called it Tornasuk, the one who gives power. It was like the landslide that had almost caught her in Melis Chasma, now a part of her life forever. Facing the landslide, she hadn't moved a muscle. This time she had run like hell. Mars could kill her, no doubt it would kill her. But no big zoo creature from Earth was going to kill her, not if she could help it. Not that she was so enamored of life. Far from it. But one should be free to choose one's death, as she had chosen in the past. Twice, at least. But Simon and then Sax, like little brown bears, had snatched her death away from her. She still didn't know what to make of that, how to feel about it. Her mind was racing so fast. She held on to the back of the driver's seat. Finally, she reached forward and punched Sax's old first 100 number on the rover's screen keyboard, XY23. And waited for the AI to route the call to the shuttle returning Sax and the others to Mars. And after a while, there he was, with his new face, staring into a screen. "Why did you do it?" she shouted. "It's my death to choose as I please." She waited for the message to reach him. Then it did, and he jumped. The image of him jiggled. "Because," he said, and stopped. Anne felt a chill. That was just what Simon had said after he had pulled her back in out of the chaos. They never had a reason. Only life's idiot because. Sax went on. "I didn't want... It seemed like such a waste. What a surprise to hear from you. I'm glad." "To hell with that," Anne said. She was about to cut the connection when he started speaking again. They were in simultaneous transmission now, alternating messages. "It was so I could talk to you, Anne. I mean, it was for myself. I didn't want to be missing you. I wanted you to forgive me. I wanted to argue with you more and make you see why I've done what I've done." His chatter stopped as abruptly as it had started, and then he looked confused, even frightened. Perhaps he had just heard, "To hell with that." She could scare him, no doubt of that. "What crap?" she said, after a while. "Yes. How are you doing? You look..." She cut the connection. "I just outran a polar bear," she shouted in her mind. "I was almost eaten by your stupid games." No, she wouldn't tell him. The meddler. He had needed a good referee for his submissions to the Meta-Journal of Martian History. That was what it came down to. Making sure his science was properly peer-reviewed. For that, he would crash around in a person's most inward desires, in her essential freedom to choose life or death, to be a free human being. At least he hadn't tried to lie about it. And, well, here she was. Rage, remorse without cause, inexplicable anguish, a strangely painful exhilaration. All this filled her at once. The limbic system, vibrating madly, spiking every thought with contradictory wild emotions, disconnected from the thought's content. Sachs had saved her. She hated him. She felt a fierce joy. Cassay was dead. Peter wasn't. No bear could kill her, etc., and on and on and on. Oh, so strange. She spotted a little green rover perched on a bluff over the ice bay. Impulsively, she took over the wheel and drove up to it. A little face peered out at her. She waved through the windshields at it. Black eyes, spectacles, bald, like her stepfather. She parked her rover next to his. The man gestured for her to come over, holding up a wooden spoon. He looked vague, only half pulled out of his own thoughts. Anne put on a down jacket and went through the locked doors and walked between the cars, feeling the shock of the frigid air like a dousing in cold water. It was nice to be able to walk between one rover and another without suiting up or, to get to the crux of the matter, risking death. Amazing that more people hadn't been killed by carelessness or lock malfunction. Some had been, of course. Scores, probably, if you added them all up. Now it was just a dash of cold air. The bald man opened his inner lock door. "Hello," he said, and offered a hand. "Hello," Anne said, and shook it. "I'm Anne."
"I'm Harry. Harry Whitebook."
"Ah, I've heard of you. You design animals."
He smiled gently. "Yes." No shame, no defensiveness.
"I was just chased by one of your polar bears today."
"Were you?" His eyes opened round. "Those are fast."
"So they are. But they're not just polar bears, are they?"
"They've got some grizzly genes for altitude, but mostly it's just Ursus maritimus. They're very tough creatures."
"A lot of creatures are."
"Yes, isn't it marvelous? Oh, excuse me, have you eaten? Would you like some soup? I was just making soup, leek soup. I guess it must be obvious." It was.
"Sure," Anne said. Over soup and bread, she asked him questions about the polar bear. "Surely there can't be a whole food chain here for something that huge."
"Oh, yes. In this area, there is. It's well known for that. The first bioregion robust enough for bears. The bay is liquid to the bottom, you see. The AP Mohole is at the center of the crater, so it's like a bottomless lake. Iced over in winter, of course, but the bears are used to that from the Arctic."
"The winters are long."
"Yes. The female bears make dens in the snow near some caves in dike outcroppings to the west. They don't truly hibernate. Their body temperatures drop just a few degrees, and they can wake up in a minute or two if they need to adjust the den for heat. So they den for as much of the winters as they can, then live in there and forage out till spring. Then in spring we tow some of the ice plates through the mouth of the bay out to sea, and things develop from there, bottom to top. The basic chains are Antarctic in the water, Arctic on the land. Plankton, krill, fish and squid, Weddell seals, and on land, rabbits and hares, lemmings, marmots, mice, lynx, bobcat, and the bears. We're trying with caribou and reindeer and wolves, but there isn't the forage for ungulates yet. The bears have been out just a few years. The air pressure hasn't been adequate until recently. But it's a 4,000-meter equivalent here now, and the bears do very well with that, we find. They adapt very quickly.
Humans, too.
Well, we haven't seen too much at the 4,000-meter level yet. He meant 4,000 meters above sea level on Earth. Higher than any permanent human settlement, as she recalled. He was going on. Eventually we see thoracic cavity expansion bound to happen. A man who talked to himself. Big, bulky. White fur and a fringe around his bald pate. Black eyes swimming behind round spectacles.
"Did you ever meet Hiroko?" she said.
"Hiroko, I did once. Lovely woman. I hear she's gone back to Earth to help them adapt to the flood. Did you know her?"
"Yes. I'm Anne Claiborne."
"I thought so. Peter Claiborne's mother, isn't that right?
Yes.
He's been in Boone recently.
Boone?
That's the little station across the bay. This is Botany Bay, and the station is Boone Harbor. A kind of joke. Apparently there was a similar pairing in Australia.
Indeed.
She shook her head. John would be with them forever, and by no means the worst of the ghosts haunting them. As, for instance, this man, the famous animal designer. He clattered about the kitchen, pawing at things short-sightedly. He put the soup before her, and she ate, watching him furtively as she did. He knew who she was, but he didn't seem uncomfortable. He didn't try to justify himself. She was a red areologist. He designed new Martian animals. They worked on the same planet. But that didn't mean they were enemies, not to him. He would eat with her without malice. There was something chilling in that, overbearing despite his gentle manner. Obliviousness was so brutal. And yet she liked him, that dispassionate power, vagueness, something. He bumbled around his kitchen, sat and ate with her, quickly and noisily, his muzzle wet with the clear soup stock. Afterward, they broke pieces of bread from a long loaf. Anne asked questions about Boone Harbor. "It has a good bakery," White Book said, indicating the loaf, "and a good lab. The rest is just an ordinary outpost. But we took the tent down last year, and now it's very cold, especially in the winter. Only 46 degrees latitude, but we feel it as a northern place. So much so that there's some talk of putting the tent back up, in winter at least. And there are people who say we should leave it on until things warm up.
Till the ice age is over?
I don't think there will be an ice age. This first year without the Saleta was bad, of course, but various compensations ought to be possible. A cold couple of years, that's all it will be." He waggled a paw. It could go either way. Anne almost threw her chunk of bread at him, but best not to startle him. She controlled herself with a shudder.
"Is Peter still in Boone?" she asked.
"I think so. He was a few days ago. They talked some more about the Botany Bay ecosystem. Without a fuller array of plant life, animal designers were sharply limited. It was still more like the Antarctic than the Arctic in that respect. Possibly new soil enhancement methods could speed the arrival of higher plants. Right now it was a land of lichen, for the most part. The tundra plants would follow." "But this displeases you," he observed.
"I liked it the way it was before. All Vastitas Borealis was barken dunes, made of black garnet sand."
"Won't some remain, up next to the polar cap?"
"The ice cap will go right down to the sea line in most places. As you say, kind of like Antarctica. No, the dunes and the laminate terrain will be underwater one way or another. The whole northern hemisphere will be gone."
"This is the northern hemisphere."
"A highland peninsula. And it's gone, too, in a way. Botany Bay was Arcadia Crater, AP.
He looked at her through the spectacles, peering. "Perhaps if you lived at high altitude, it might seem like the old days. The old days with air."
"Perhaps," she said cautiously.
He was circling the chamber, shambling about with heavy steps, cleaning big kitchen knives at the sink. His fingers ended in short, blunt claws. Even clipped, they made it hard for him to work with small objects. She stood up carefully.
"Thanks for dinner,"
she said, backing toward the locked door. She grabbed her jacket on the way out and slammed the door on his look of surprise. Out into the hard, cold slap of the night, into her jacket. Never run away from a predator. She walked back to her car and climbed in without looking back. The ancient highland of Tempe Terra was dotted by a number of small volcanoes, so there were lava plains and channels everywhere.
also viscous creep features caused by ground ice and the occasional small outflow channel that had run down the side of the great escarpment. All this along with the usual collection of Noachian impact and deformational features, so that on the areological maps, Tempe looked like an artist's palette, colors splashed everywhere to indicate the different aspects of the region's long history. Too many colors, in Anne's opinion. For her, the smallest divisions into different areological units were artificial, remnants of sky areology, attempting to distinguish between regions that were more cratered or more dissected or more etched than the rest, when in the field it was all one, with all of the signature features visible everywhere. It was simply rough country, a Noachian landscape, none rougher. Even the floors of the long straight canyons called the Tempe Fossa were too broken to drive over, so Anne made her way indirectly on higher land. The most recent lava flows, a billion years old, were harder than the disaggregated ejecta they had run over, and now they stood on the land as long dikes or berms. On the softer land between, there were a lot of splosh craters, their aprons clearly the remnants of liquid flow, like drip castles on the beach. Occasional islands of worn bedrock stuck up out of all this debris, but by and large it was regolith, with signs everywhere of water in the land, of the permafrost underfoot, causing slow slumps and creeps. And now, with the increase in temperatures, and perhaps the heat coming up from the Vastatas underground explosions, all that creep had speeded up. There were new landslides all over the place. A well-known red trail had been wiped out when a ramp into Tempe 12 had been buried. The walls of Tempe 18 had collapsed on both sides, making a U-shaped canyon into a V-shaped one. Tempe 21 was gone, covered by the collapse of its high west wall. Everywhere the land was melting. She even saw some taliks, which were liquefied zones on top of permafrost, basically icy swamps. And many of the oval pits of the great oases were filled with ponds, which melted by day and froze by night, an action that tore the land apart even faster. She passed the lobate apron of Timoshenko Crater, buried on its northern flank by the southernmost waves of lava from Coriolanus Volcano, the largest of the many little volcanoes in Tempe. Here the land was extensively pitted, and snow had fallen, melted, and then refrozen in myriad catchment bases. The land was slumping in all the characteristic permafrost patterns, polygonal pebble ridges, concentric crater fill, pingos, soliflexion ridges on hillsides. In every depression, an ice-choked pond or puddle. The land was melting. On sunny, south-facing slopes, wherever there was a bit of protection from the wind, trees were growing over understories of moss and grass and shrub. In the sun-filled hollows were Krumholtz dwarf trees, gnarled over their matted needles. In the shaded hollows, dirty snow and fern. The ruination of so much land. Broken land, empty but not empty. Rock and ice and boggy meadow all lined by shattered low ridges. Clouds puffed out of nothing in the afternoon heat, and their shadows were another set of patches on things, a crazy quilt of red and black, green and white. No one would ever complain of homogeneity on Tempe Terra. Everything perfectly still under the rapidly moving shadows of the clouds. And yet there, one evening in the dusk, a white bulk slipping behind a boulder. Her heart jumped, but there was nothing further to see. But she had seen something, because just before full darkness, there was a knocking at the door. Her heart shuddered like the rover on its shock absorbers. She ran to a window, looked out. Figures the color of the rock, waving hands. Human beings. It was a little group of red écouteurs. They had recognized her rover, they said after she let them inside, from the description given by the people at the Tempe Refuge. They had been hoping they might run into her. And so they were happy, laughing, chattering, moving around the cabin to touch her, young, tall natives with stone eye teeth and gleaming young eyes, some of them Orientals, some white, some black, all happy.
She recognized them from Pavonis Mons, not individually, but as a group. The Young Fanatics. Again, she felt a chill. "Where are you going?" she asked.
"To Botany Bay," a young woman replied. "We're going to take out the White Book Labs."
"And Boone Station," another added.
"Ah, no,"
Anne said. They went still, looked at her carefully, like Cassay and Dow in Last Flow.
"What do you mean?" the young woman said.
Anne took a breath, tried to figure that out. They were watching her closely.
"Were you there in Sheffield?" she asked.
They nodded. They knew what she meant.
"Then you should know already," she said slowly. "It's pointless to achieve a red Mars by pouring blood over the planet. We have to find another way. We can't do it by killing people. Not even by killing animals or plants or blowing up machines. It won't work. It's destructive. It doesn't appeal to people, do you understand? No one is won over. In fact, they're put off. The more we do things like that, the more green they become. So we defeat our purpose. If we know that and do it anyway, then we're betraying the purpose, do you understand? We aren't doing it for anything but our own feelings, because we're angry. Or for thrills. We have to find another way." They stared at her, uncomprehending, annoyed, shocked, contemptuous, but riveted. This was Anne Claiborne, after all. "I don't know for sure what that other way is," she went on. "I can't tell you that. I think... that's what I think we have to start working on. It has to be something like a red areophany. The areophany has always been understood as a green thing, right from the start. I suppose because of Hiroko, because she took the lead in defining it, and in bringing it into being. So the areophany has always been mixed up with Veriditas, but there's no reason that should be. We have to change that or we'll never accomplish anything. There has to be a red worship of this place that people can learn to feel. The redness of the primal planet has to become a counterforce to Veriditas. We have to stain that green until it turns some other color. Some color like you see in certain stones like jasper or ferric serpentine. You see what I mean? It will mean taking people out onto the land, maybe, up into the highlands so they can see what it is. It will mean moving there, all over the place, and establishing tenure and stewardship rights so that we can speak for the land and they will have to listen. Wanderers' rights as well. Areologists' rights. Nomads' rights. That's what aereoformation might mean. Do you understand? She stopped. The young natives were still attentive, now looking perhaps concerned for her, or concerned at what she had said. "We've talked about this kind of thing before," one young man said. "And there are people doing it. Sometimes we do it, but we think an active resistance is a necessary part of the struggle. Otherwise, we'll just get steamrolled. They'll green everything."
"Not if we stain it all. Right from the inside, right from their hearts, too. But sabotage, murder, it's green that springs out of all that. Believe me, I've seen it. I've been fighting just as long as you, and I've seen it. You stomp on life, and it just comes back stronger."
The young man wasn't convinced. "They gave us the 6-kilometer limit because they were scared of us, because we were the driving force behind the revolution. If it weren't for us fighting, the Metanats would still rule everything here."
"That was a different opponent. When we fought the Terrans, then the Martian Greens were impressed. When we fight the Martian Greens, they're not impressed. They're angry, and they get more green than ever."
The group sat in silence, thoughtful, perhaps disheartened.
"But what do we do?" a gray-haired woman said.
"Go to some land that's endangered," Anne suggested. She gestured out the window. "Right here wouldn't be bad. Or somewhere near the 6K border. Settle,
Incorporate a town. Make it a primal refuge. Make it a wonderful place. We'll creep back down from the highlands.
They considered this glumly.
Or go into the cities and start a tour group and a legal fund. Show people the land. Sue every change they propose.
Shit, the young man said, shaking his head. That sounds awful.
Yes, it does, Anne said. There's ugly work to be done. But we have to get them from the inside, too, and that's where they live.
Long faces. They sat around and talked about it some more. The way they lived now, the way they wanted to live. What they might do to get from one to the other. The impossibility of the guerrilla life after the war was over. And so on. There were lots of big sighs, some tears, recriminations, encouragements. Come with me tomorrow and take a straight look at this ice sea, Anne suggested. The next day, the guerrilla group traveled south with her along the 60th longitude, kilometer by difficult kilometer. Kala, the Arabs called it. The empty land. On the one hand, it was beautiful, a Noachian desolation of rockscapes, and their hearts were full. On the other hand, the Eco-Turs were quiet, subdued, as if on a pilgrimage in some uncertain funereal mode. Together, they came to the big canyon called Nilocharis Scopulus and dropped into it on a broad, rough, natural ramp. To the east lay Chrysi Planitia, covered by ice, another arm of the northern sea. They hadn't escaped it. Ahead to the south lay the Nilocharis Fossae, the terminal end of a canyon complex that began far to the south in the enormous pit of Hebe's Chasma. Hebe's Chasma had no exit, but its subsidence was now understood to have been caused by the aquifer outbreak just to the west, at the top of Echis Chasma. A very great amount of water had gushed down Echis, against the hard western side of Luni Planum, carving the steep high cliff of Echis Overlook. Then it had come to a break in that stupendous cliff, and had rushed down and through, tearing the big bend of Cassae Vallis and cutting a deep channel out onto the lowlands of Chrysi. It had been one of the biggest aquifer outbreaks in Martian history. Now the northern sea had flowed back into Chrysi, and water was filling back into the lower end of Nilocharis and Cassae. The flat-topped hill that was Sharanoff Crater stood like a giant castle keep on the high promontory over the mouth of this new fjord. Out in the middle of the fjord lay a long, narrow island, one of the Lemniscate Islands of the ancient flood, now islanded again, stubbornly red in the sea of white ice. Eventually this fjord would make an even better harbor than Botany Bay. It was steep-walled, but there were benches tucked here and there that could become harbor towns. There would, of course, be the west wind funneling down Cassae to worry about, katabatic onslaughts holding the sailing ships out in the Chrysi Gulf. So strange. She led the group of silent reds to a ramp that got them down onto a broad bench to the west of the ice fjord. By then it was evening, and she led them out of the rovers and down to the shore for a sunset walk. At the moment of sunset itself, they found themselves standing in a tight, unhappy cluster before a solitary ice block some 4 meters tall, its melted convexities as smooth as muscle. They stood so that the sun was behind the ice block and shining through it. To both sides of the block, brilliant light gleamed off the glassy, wet sand. An admonition of light. Undeniable, blazingly real. What were they to make of it? They stood and stared in silence. When the sun blinked out over the black horizon, Anne walked away from the group and went alone up to her rover. She looked back down the slope. The reds were still there by the beached iceberg. It looked like a white god among them, tinted orange like the crumpled white sheet of the ice bay. White god, bear, bay, a dolmen of Martian ice. The ocean would be there with them forever, as real as the rock. The next day, she drove up Cassay Vallis to the west, toward Ecus Chasma. Up and up she drove, on broad bench after bench, making easy progress until she came to where Cassay curved left and up onto the floor of Ecus. The curve was one of the biggest, most obvious water-carved features on the planet, but now she found that the flat arroyo floor was covered by dwarf trees, so small they were almost shrubs, black-barked, thorny, the dark green leaves as glossy and razor-edged as holly leaves. Moss blanketed the ground underneath these black trees, but very little else. It was a single-species forest covering Cassay Vallis from canyon wall to canyon wall, filling the great curve like some oversized smut. By necessity, Anne drove right over the top of the low forest, and the rover tilted this way and that as the branches, tough as manzanita, stubbornly gave under its wheels and then whipped back into place when they were freed. It would be nearly impossible to walk through this canyon anymore, Anne thought, this deep-walled canyon so narrow and rounded, a kind of Utah of the imagination, or so it had been, now like the black forest of a fairy tale, inescapable, filled with flying black things and a white shape seen scuttling in the dusk. There was no sign of the Unta security complex that had once occupied the turn of the valley. A curse on your house to the seventh generation, a curse on the innocent land as well. Sax had been tortured here, and so he had sown fire seed in the ground and torched the place, causing a thorn forest to sprout and cover it. And they called scientists rational creatures. A curse on their house, too, Anne thought with teeth clenched, to the seventh generation and seven after that. She hissed and drove on, up Ecus toward the steep volcanic cone of Tharsis Tholus. There was a town there, tucked on the side of the volcano where the slope leveled off. The bear had told her Peter was headed there, and so she avoided it. Peter, the land drowned. Sax, the land burned. Once he had been hers. On this rock I will build. Peter Tempe Terra, the rock of the land of time, the new man, Homo Marshall. Who had betrayed them? Remember. On she drove south, up the slope of the Tharsis Bulge until the cone of Ascrius hove into view, a mountain continent puncturing the horizon. Pavonis had been infested and overgrown because of its equatorial position and the little advantage that that gave the elevator cable. But Ascrius, just 500 kilometers northeast of Pavonis, had been left alone. No one lived there. Very few people had ever even ascended it. Just a few areologists now and then to study its lava and occasional pyroclastic ash flows, which were both colored the red nearest black. She drove on to its lower slopes, gentle and wavy. Ascrius had been one of the classic albedo feature names, as it was a mountain so big it was easily visible from Earth. Ascrius Lacus. This was during the canal mania, and so they had decided it was a lake. Pavonis in that era had been called Phoenicus Lacus, Phoenix Lake. Ascra, she read, was the birthplace of Hesiod, situated on the right of Mount Helicon, on a high and rugged place. So though they had thought it a lake, they had named it after a mountain place. Perhaps their subconscious minds had understood the telescopic images after all. Ascrius was in general a poetic name for the pastoral, Helicon being the Boeotian mountain sacred to Apollo and the Muses. Hesiod had looked up from his plow one day and seen the mountain and found he had a story to tell. Strange the birth of myth. Strange the old names that they lived among and ignored, while they continued to tell the old stories over and over again with their lives. It was the steepest of the big four volcanoes, but there was no encircling escarpment as around Olympus Mons. So she could put the rover in low gear and grind on up as if taking off into space in slow motion, lean back in her seat and take a nap. Head on the headrest. Relax. Wake up on arrival, up at 27 kilometers above sea level, the same height as all the other three big ones. That was as high as a mountain could get on Mars, basically. It was the isostatic limit, at which point the lithosphere began to sag under the weight of all that rock. All of the big four had maxed out. They could grow no higher. A sign of their size and their great age. Very old, yes, but at the same time the surface lava of Ascrius was among the youngest igneous rock on Mars, weathered only slightly by wind and sun. As the lava sheets had cooled, they had stiffened in their descent, leaving low, curved bulges to ascend or bypass. A distinct trail of rover tracks zigzagged up the slope, avoiding steep sections at the bottoms of these flows, taking advantage of a big, loose network of ramps and flowbacks. In any permanent shade, spindrift had settled into banks of dirty, hard-packed snow. Shadows were now a filmy black and white, as if she drove through a photographic negative, her spirits plummeting inexplicably as she drove ever higher. Behind her, she could see more and more of the conical northern flank of the volcano, and North Tharsis beyond that, all the way to the Echis Wall, a low line over 100 kilometers away. Much of what she could see was patchy with snowdrifts, wind slab, fern, freckled white. The shady sides of volcanic cones often became heavily glaciated. There, on a rock face, bright emerald moss. Everything was turning green.
This ends side two of cassette 8 of Blue Mars. Please fast forward to the end before loading cassette 9.